All I knew for certain was that I had to work swiftly. No human body can survive such long, drawn-out anguish. I had no other guidelines to follow. There was no other surgeon in this world who would ever dare to go where I was preparing to venture. I had one remaining flask of the red Shepan that might be sufficient to keep Zaras unconscious for an hour at the longest. I would need all of it. I would have to open the stomach cavity and find where Zaras' entrails had been punctured. I would have to repair the sword cuts by sewing them together. Then I would have to flush out the evil humours that had escaped from his bowels into his stomach cavity. Fortunately, like all of us, Zaras had eaten little since leaving the Maya cave. We were short of food, and I had rationed our stores strictly. His gut would not be full of waste. I had infusions of willow bark and cedar sap, but insufficient quantities for the task of flushing out the poisons. The most efficacious of all was distillate of wine. I had only one small water skin full of this. Both Tehuti and I washed our hands in a single small bowl of this precious liquid. I had long ago discovered that heat will reduce, if not destroy, the humours. On my instructions, two of my men set a large pot of water on the fire. When the water was boiling furiously, I dangled my bronze surgical razors, needles, and catgut sutures into it. I forced another large dose of the red Shepan down Zaras' gullet, while Tehuti sponged his belly with the distillate of wine. Then my hefty guardsmen pinned Zaras down once more. I placed a doubled leather pad between his teeth so that they would not crack and shatter when his jaws clamped down in a seizure of agony. All was in readiness. I could find no other excuse to delay longer. I made the first long cut through the wall of his belly, from just below his belly button to the crest of his pubic bone. Zaras howled through his leather gag, and he whipped his head from side to side. I showed Tehuti how to hold the wound open by hooking her fingers into each side of my long incision and pulling the lips apart. I was now able to get both my hands into the cavity of his belly as deep as my wrists. I had a picture in my mind of the course that the sword blade had taken as it was driven into his belly, and I worked along this route. Almost at once, I found a perforation as long as my little finger in the slippery rope of his guts. The stinking debris of digested food was oozing from the aperture. I sewed it closed with catgut and neat regular stitches of my curved bronze needle. Then I took the rubbery snake of the gut and squeezed it in my two hands to make certain that there were no leaks. My suture was watertight, but the pressure forced the brown and turbid filth to squirt from three other cuts deeper in his bowels. I sewed these smaller cuts closed, working with a delicate balance of speed to efficacy. I could see that Zaras was beginning to weaken under this extreme treatment that I was forced to inflict upon him. By the time I was satisfied that I had not overlooked any other damage that the blade had caused, both Tehuti and I were inured to the fecal stench. Nonetheless, it was a constant reminder to me how vital it was to wash out all the humours from his body before I closed his gaping stomach cavity. Anything that stank so atrociously must be evil. With Tehuti still holding his stomach open, I took mouthfuls of the distillate of wine and squirted it through my pursed lips into the recesses and convolutions of his bowels. Then we rolled him on his side and drained the fluid out of his belly. Then we washed out his guts again with boiled water, which had cooled to body temperature, and drained that out of him. Finally, we washed him out with our own urine. This is one of the most effective recipes against the humours, but the urine must be fresh and uncontaminated by any other fluid or bodily substance. Ideally, it should come directly from a healthy bladder, without contacting the external sexual parts of the donor, the penis and foreskin of the male or female labia. With me, this presented no difficulty. The removal of the emblems of my sex is such ancient history that their memory no longer causes me even a tremor. While I emptied my water into Zaras, Tehuti swabbed her own privates with a woolen pad soaked in the distilled wine. When I stood aside, she squatted over Zaras and spread the lips of her vulva. Then she aimed a hissing stream into his belly cavity. When she had finished, we rolled Zaras' inert form onto his side to drain for the third and last time. Then I closed up his belly, and with each stitch I recited a verse from the prayer for the closing of a wound. I close your cruel red mouth, O evil thing of Seth. Leave this place, I command you, go. Retreat from me, jackal-headed Anubis, god of the cemeteries. Let this one live. Weep for him, gentle-hearted Hathor. Show him your mercy and ease his pain. Let him live. It was dark by the time I had trussed up his belly with linen strips torn from the skirts of my robe and laid him on the litter in his shelter. Tehuti and I sat on each side of him, ready to give whatever comfort and succour we could. When Zaras in delirium began to rant at and struggle with the imaginary and real demons that crowded around his litter, Tehuti lay down beside him and took him in her arms. She held him tightly and sang to him. I recognized the lullaby. It was one of those that Queen Lostris had sung to Tehuti when she was an infant. Gradually, Zaras quietened. His men built their watchfires in a circle around the shelter in which we waited with Zaras. I think they prayed for him as we did. I heard the murmur of their voices throughout the long, hot night. Towards the dawn I fell asleep. There was nothing further that I could do other than husband my reserves for the ministrations which I knew I would soon be called upon to render. I felt a small hot hand tugging at my shoulder, and I came awake instantly. I saw through the chinks in the roof of our shelter that morning was not far off. I had slept only briefly, but I felt as guilty as if I had committed murder. "Taita, wake up! You must help me!" I could hear the effort she was making to prevent herself from weeping. "What is it, princess?" "His skin is on fire. Zaras is burning up inside. He is so hot, it is almost painful to touch him." I had a cedarwood taper to hand. I thrust the tip of it into the dying coals of the fire and blew upon it. When it burst into flames, I lit the oil lamp at the head of the litter, and I bent over Zaras. His face was flushed and shining with sweat. His eyes were open but unseeing with delirium. When we tried to hold him still and quieten him, he lashed out at us. He rolled his head from side to side and screamed curses at us. I had been expecting this. I knew well the burning fever which heralds the onslaught of the evil humours. I had seen many cases that exhibited almost exactly the same symptoms. They had all ended in the death of the patient, but I had prepared my first line of defence. I summoned my six stalwarts, and between us we were able to truss Zaras in a cocoon of saddle blankets, so that he was unable to do more than move his head. Then we soaked all the blankets with buckets of water and fanned them to speed up the evaporation. This reduced the temperature of Zaras' body until he was shivering with the relative chill. We kept this up through most of the morning, but by noon Zaras' strength was fading. He was following the same course that all my previous patients with the humours had taken. He no longer had the strength to resist the treatment I was forcing upon him. He uttered no sound but the chattering of his teeth. His skin had taken on a pale blue tinge. We unwrapped him, and Tehuti took him in her arms again and looked at me across his wet and quivering body. "You said that you could save him, Taita, but now I understand that you cannot do so." The depths of her despair cut me as deeply as the jackal's sword had wounded Zaras. In the time of the Exodus, when we Egyptians were driven from our homeland by the Hyksos invaders, we escaped, south, through the cataracts of the Nile into the remotest Africa. For many wandering years, we survived in the wilderness, until we grew strong enough to return and win back our birthright. During that time, I learned how to know and understand the black tribes. They had strengths and special skills that I envied. I was particularly attracted to the Shilluk tribe, and I made many good friends among them. One of these was an ancient medicine man named Umtagas. Others of our company looked upon him as a primitive witch doctor who consorted with demons. They considered him to be barely one level above the wild animals that abounded in that far southern land. But I came to realize that he was a sage, with a grasp of many things that eluded us interlopers from the north. He taught me more than I was able to teach him. When the weight of his years finally overwhelmed him, and he was only days away from dying, he pressed into my hands a leather bag of sun-dried black mushrooms, of a type that I had never seen before. They were covered in a thick green mould. He cautioned me not to remove this mould, as it was an essential element of the medicine's healing powers. Then he instructed me how to prepare from these fungi a draught, which he warned me killed more often than it cured. I should employ it only when it was all that stood between my patient and the void. Over the years since the return to our very Egypt, I have dared to use this infusion on only 7 occasions. In each case, my patient was moribund, with merely the weight of a sunbird's feather preventing him from being tipped over the edge of eternity. 5 of my patients expired almost as soon as the draught passed their lips. 1 struggled on the brink for 10 days, slowly gaining ground all the time, until the end came abruptly and unexpectedly. Only my 7th patient has survived the arrow through his lung and the evil humours that followed that wounding. He has grown strong again. He lives in Thebes, and each year on the anniversary of what he refers to as my miracle, he comes to visit me with all his grandchildren. I know full well that 1 out of 7 is hardly a score to boast about, but I could see that Zaras had about 1 hour of his life left to live, and Tehuti was looking at me with those huge, reproachful eyes. There was less than a handful of the mouldy mushrooms remaining in the gazelle-skin bag. I boiled them in a copper pot of water until the juice was black and sticky. Then I allowed it to cool before I placed a wooden wedge in the corner of Zaras' jaw to keep his mouth open while I spooned the concoction into him. I have tasted a drop of this elixir on only 1 previous occasion. It was an experiment which I have no intention of ever repeating. Zaras' reaction to the taste accorded with mine. He fought so wildly that it took my 6 helpers and Tehuti to subdue him, and then he vomited up more than half of what I had forced him to swallow. I scraped up his returns and fed them to him a 2nd time. Then I removed the wedge from between his jaws and held his mouth closed until I was certain that my precious mushrooms remained below decks, despite his repeated attempts to offload them once more. Then Tehuti and I wrapped him in saddle blankets and sent the others away. We sat 1 on each side of him and waited for him to die. By nightfall, he seemed to have achieved this state. Despite the blankets, his temperature had plummeted to that of a freshly netted catfish, and his breathing was almost inaudible. The 2 of us took turns in placing an ear to his mouth to listen for it. A little after midnight, when the moon had set, Tehuti told me firmly, "He is cold as any corpse. I have to lie with him to keep him warm." She removed the blood-stained and ill-fitting clothes that I had collected for her from the carcasses of the Bedouin, and climbed under the blanket with Zaras. Neither of us had slept for the last 3 days, but we did not sleep now, and we did not talk. There was nothing left for us to say to each other. We had given up hope. The graveyard hour came upon us, the darkest hour of the night. There was an aperture in the roof of our shelter where 2 blankets had been roughly joined. I looked up and saw that in it, the great red wandering star which we know is the Eye of Seth, was perfectly framed. The evil god was looking in upon us. My spirit quailed. I knew that Zaras had lost the battle, and that Seth had come to take him. Then a strange and wonderful thing happened. The light of the star was snuffed out in an instant. My heart jumped against my ribs. I could not fathom the omen, but I knew it must be good. I rose silently to my feet so as not to alarm Tahuti where she was huddled in the litter with Zaras. I ducked through the entrance to our shelter, and I lifted my head to look up at the night sky. The entire firmament blazed with the glow of countless stars, except in the spot directly above my head, where a moment earlier I had seen the red eye of Seth staring down at me. Now, the eye had been obscured. A tiny, dark cloud covered it. It was the only cloud in the sky. It was no larger than my fist, but the malignant god Seth had been blinded by it. Then I heard voices. They came not from the starry sky above me, but from the rude shelter which I had just left. "Where am I?" whispered the voice of Zaras. "And why does my belly ache so abominably?" Then the voice I knew so well answered him immediately. "Don't try to stand up, Zaras, you silly man. You must lie still. You have been sorely wounded. Princess Tahuti, you are in my bed." Zaras' voice rose with shock and trepidation. "And you are without clothing. If Taita finds us like this, he will kill the both of us." "Not this time, Zaras," I assured him, as I ducked back into the shelter, with my heart singing, and knelt beside the litter on which the couple lay. "But the next time, I will do so for certain." As soon as the daylight was strong enough, I examined Zaras minutely. His skin had cooled, so that it was the same temperature as my hand. The vivid inflammation had faded from the punctures of the stitches I had placed in the great wound in his belly. I sniffed the scabs, and they were clean. Zaras was thirsty, and Tahuti brought him a large bowl of water. He drank it and asked for more. I was elated. This was a certain sign that he was on the mend. However, it was also a reminder that the water skins were almost empty, and that the nearest fresh water was at the cavern, where we had left Bekatha and the rest of our company. We must start the return immediately. Although Zaras protested that he was able to walk, or at the very least to ride a camel, I ignored this bravado, and I designed and assembled a drag litter for him. This was composed of two long lances, with saddle cloth stretched between them. This I attached to each side of a camel saddle, with the tips of the lance poles dragging behind the beast. We laid Zaras on his stretcher. Tahuti insisted on riding on his camel. She sat facing backwards so she could watch over him. When the ground was uneven and rocky, she jumped down and climbed into the litter with Zaras, to hold him and cushion him from being shaken too roughly. During the course of our journey, she fussed over him and bullied him shamelessly, and although he protested, I could tell he was reveling in her attentions. On the afternoon of the third day, he insisted on climbing out of his litter and walking beside it for a short stretch, doubled over and hobbling along like an old man. He supported himself with one hand on the litter. Tahuti took his other arm to balance him and encourage him. She chattered to him, making silly little jokes and telling him what a clever boy he was. When she made him laugh, he had to stop to clutch his belly with both hands, but that didn't seem to place a limit on his capacity for mirth. When we stopped to rest, I examined Zara's stitches anxiously and was relieved to find that they were intact. I administered the last mouthful of the red shepherd, which remained in the flask, and he slept like an infant. On the following day he was stronger, and he walked further and faster. I knew that for him Tahuti's company was more therapeutic than mine, so I moved forward to the vanguard of our column. Although I kept discreetly out of earshot, I was able to follow their conversation. Both of them were still totally oblivious to my skills as a lip-reader, so they spoke to each other without restraint. Some of their humour was ribald and indelicate for a young lady of such high birth, but I let them enjoy the moment, for none of us knew when they might share another. There was one exchange between them that has stayed with me to this day, although they must have thought that they were the only persons in the world to have been party to it. The rate of our progress had been limited by Zara's condition, so our return to the Maya cave was much slower than our pursuit of the jackal and his gang of bandits had been. On the fifth day, we had still not reached our destination. I had sent 5 fast camels ahead to fetch water for us, but they had still not yet returned. Almost all the water skins were empty, and we had very little food remaining. I had been obliged to reduce the daily ration to 3 small mugs of water and 1/2 a loaf of hard bread per man. Naturally, this restriction did not apply to the princess. It was her royal right to eat and drink whatever she wished from our well-nigh exhausted stores. I kept a few items in reserve for her exclusive use, 1/2 a round of cheese and an even lesser amount of salted dry beef. However, despite my urging, she refused to take advantage of my largesse, and she restricted herself to the general ration. Then on the evening of the fourth day, I saw her surreptitiously slip a thick slice of hard cheese and another of the dry beef from the sleeve of her robe and try to persuade Zaras to accept them. "You are wounded, Zaras. We must husband your strength." "I'm just a common soldier, Your Highness," he protested. "You are too condescending towards me. I'm grateful for your kindness, but I'm not at all hungry."
"Gallant Zaras."
She spoke so softly and shyly that even I had difficulty reading her lips.
"You saved my life and almost sacrificed your own to do so. I would gladly give you anything you want from me."
If her words were suggestive, then her expression was unambiguous. My heart softened towards them. Their budding love was a beautiful thing to watch. I, above all men, knew that it must soon be overtaken and crushed by stern duty. So at last we reached the striated cliffs that towered above the Maya cave, and those of our company who waited for us there came thronging to meet us. They surrounded us with shouts of joy and prostrated themselves at the feet of Princess Tahuti. Then they lifted her high and carried her to where her sister Bekatha waited with Lord Remrem and Colonel Hui to welcome her. We feasted for 3 nights in succession. We killed 3 young camels and roasted their sweet flesh on the coals of 50 fires. Each evening, Princess Tahuti ordered 15 large amphorae of beer to be opened and distributed to all. I thought this was excessive, but nonetheless I suppressed my scruples and sampled a mug or two of the brew. However, I paid more respect to the less abundant offerings of wine from the cellars of Pharaoh's palace. I justified myself with the knowledge that this nectar would have been wasted on a rabble of unsophisticated soldiers. The court musicians played for us, and the company danced and sang around the fires until the moon set. Then the royal princesses prevailed on me to sing, but I called upon Zaras to join me. I had been coaching him when I had the opportunity. I had been able to give his natural ability a lustre and sophistication which was only excelled by my own. When the two of us sang a duet, the audience hardly dared breathe, lest they miss a single exquisite note of it. I went to bed feeling rather pleased with myself. Within a very short space of time, I had fallen asleep. I seldom sleep very deeply. My mind is too active and alert to allow for that form of indulgence. I awoke with a certainty that somebody had entered my tent with elaborate stealth, and in the complete darkness was hovering over my cot. I could hear his breathing, and I knew that for him to have evaded the sentries at the gates to the royal enclosure, his intentions were evil, and he must be a serious threat and menace. Without altering the pace of my own breathing, or uttering the faintest untoward sound, I reached for the dagger which always hangs in its special sheath at the head of my cot. The starlight was filtering through the cloth of my tent, and I have excellent night vision, so I was able to make out the shape of the assassin's head above me. I drew my dagger from its sheath with my right hand, and at the same time I whipped my left arm around the villain's neck in a stranglehold. If you move, I will kill you, I warned him, and he squeaked like a young girl. Then I smelled the sweet, milky odour of his breath, and felt the unmistakable swells and hollows of his body that I had locked against my own.
Don't kill me, Taita. It's me, Bekatha, and I am already dying. I came to you to save me. I am bleeding to death. Please don't let me die.
I released her with alacrity and jumped up from my cot. It took me only a minute to rekindle the wick of my oil lamp. By that time, Bekatha was curled up on my cot, sobbing pitifully and holding her stomach.
It's so sore, Taita. Please make the pain go away.
I took her tenderly in my arms. Where is it bleeding, my little one?
It's bleeding between my legs. Please make it stop. I don't want to die.
I groaned inwardly. So now I had to deal with not one, but two little fillies in Istrus. Colonel, we might soon have more to worry about, other than simply ducking pellets of bread and dates thrown at him across the dinner table. We lingered at the Maya cave, while I waited for Zara's injuries to heal sufficiently to allow him to commence the last part of the journey to the land of the two rivers and the city of Babylon. This would be the longer and most arduous leg, so I was determined not to take any risks with his health. It often surprises me how much punishment a young body can accept and how swiftly it can recover. Despite the sword that only a few days previously the jackal had driven up into his innards, and the fact that I had gutted him and then sewn him up again, Zaras acted as though he was in training for the annual athletic games that Pharaoh holds during the first week of Epiphany, before the temple of Horus in Thebes, to celebrate the harvest. At first, these exertions were only a limited and laboured walk along the base of the cliff, accompanied by Tahuti. Every 50 paces or so, he would be forced to stop and clutch at his stomach, trying not to groan and shrugging off Tahuti's proffered hand. Despite my warnings and protests, each day he extended his range and increased his speed. Soon he took to wearing full armour and carrying a slab of sandstone on his shoulder. Each day I ordered him to strip naked while I examined his wounds. They seemed to close and shrivel into pale scars even as I watched. He had a rare ability to ignore and subdue bodily pain. He forced his injured muscles to work when another less courageous person would be crippled and incapacitated for weeks and even longer. In his case, this activity seemed to accelerate the healing process rather than retard it. However, Zara's injuries had taken him to the very edge of the void. Even my vast skills had been only just sufficient to save him. And the memories of the other patients that I had treated with mouldy mushrooms were still too fresh in my mind. Quite apart from the fondness that I developed for Zaras, and the fact that he had become a symbol and proof of my curative skills, I saw in his debilitated physical condition the perfect opportunity to separate him from Princess Tahuti, before the two of them had an opportunity to completely ruin my carefully laid plans to establish an alliance between the supreme Minos of Crete and my own pharaoh Tammuz, an alliance essential to the survival of Egypt as a sovereign nation. So it was that on the fifth evening following our return to the striated cliffs, I summoned Lord Remrem and Hui to my tent to give them their new orders. I also ordered Zaras to attend the meeting. Naturally, I intended that he and Hui would be merely observers and not participants in any of the principal discussions. The four of us had just settled down to the business in hand, each of us with a goblet of fine wine on the table in front of him to ease the anguish of making the difficult decisions which confronted us, when abruptly I felt a cool draught of evening air on the back of my neck. I turned quickly, expecting to discover an eavesdropper to our deliberations. But to my consternation, Princess Tahuti floated through the entrance to the tent on a wave of her particular perfume.
Do not let me interrupt your deliberations, my lords. Please ignore me entirely. I shall say not a single word. I shall sit so quietly you will soon forget my presence entirely. To make herself entirely unobtrusive, she was wearing a splendid dress of rare golden gossamer silk, which I had purchased for her at great expense in the souk at Thebes. At the time, she had willingly agreed with my stricture not to wear it until we arrived in Crete, and she was presented to the supreme Minos for the first time. Perhaps she had forgotten our pact. On her feet she wore slippers of silver. At her throat hung the Hathor necklace, and another of sparkling coloured stones, mainly sapphires and emeralds. Her hair was a glossy miracle, exceeded only by her smile. She was as lovely as I had ever seen her. With a swirl of the golden skirts, she sat at my feet, placed her elbows on her knees and her chin in the cup of her hand, so that the diamond ring which I had given her sparkled with lights. Then she cast a sidelong smile at Zaras and tried to appear innocent. How do women know these things that are so obscure to us lesser mortals of the other gender? I had not informed her of our meeting. In fact, I had only summoned the others an hour previously, and I had given them no inkling of what I proposed to discuss. She could not possibly have known what was afoot. But here she was, dressed for battle, and with the determined glint in her eyes that I knew so well. Please continue with what you were about to say, Taita, darling. I have promised that I shall not interrupt you.
Thank you, Your Royal Highness.
I hesitated. Was there any way at all that I could avoid a confrontation? I wondered.
Of course there was. I was the bearer of the Pharaonic Hawk seal. I spoke with the voice of a king. Nobody would dare defy me.
Would they?
I gathered my courage. My lord and gentlemen, I have spoken with Al-Namju, our guide, and with Kondos, the head keeper of the royal stables. They have both agreed with me that our party is too numerous to abide here at the Maya cave any longer. I remind you that we have over 300 horses and camels, quite apart from our men and the royal ladies. At the rate that we are consuming it, within the next few days the water in the cavern will be entirely expended. As you will agree, this would be disastrous. Of course, no question about it. We have to move on.
As he voiced his agreement, Remrem stroked his beard, which I knew was silvery grey, but which he dyed bright ginger with henna to conceal his true age. He is a great lord, and a cunning and valiant warrior. I love him as if he were my brother, which in many ways he is. However, Remrem does have one failing. He is quite insufferably vain about his appearance. I nodded my thanks for his support and went on speaking.
It is not quite as simple as that, my lord. Al-Namju tells me that the next oasis on our route is called Zainab, which means precious jewel. It is over 200 leagues ahead of us. It will take 10 days to cover that distance. This means that when we reach it, our livestock will be exhausted and suffering grievously from thirst. We will have to rest them at Zainab for at least 2 weeks to allow them to recover. However, Zainab is a small oasis. The water that it contains is insufficient to supply the needs of our entire company for more than a mere few days.
I paused to let Remrem or someone else suggest the logical solution to this quandary. This would enable me to divert some of the blame to the other party, when Princess Tehuti cast us all into turmoil and uproar, which she would certainly do as soon as she learned all the ramifications of my plan. There was a heavy silence, so I was forced to continue and face the consequences alone.
The only solution is for us to split our company, to send half our men and animals ahead to Zainab. The other half will remain here for 2 weeks to give them a start. We will maintain this separation for the remainder of our journey. We will not reassemble until we reach the land of the two rivers. In this manner, We will never be in danger of entirely exhausting the water in any one oasis of our combined numbers. There was a silence as they all considered this. As ever, your plan has much merit, Taita, Remrem spoke at last in his great rumbling voice. And if I know you at all, you will already have decided on the division of our forces. I smiled and bowed my head slightly in acquiescence. You, my lord Remrem, will take command of the vanguard. This will comprise half the men and all the camels. In addition, you will take under your care the royal ladies, Princess Bekatha and Princess Tahuti. Naturally, the Cretan girl Loxias will go with them as their lady-in-waiting. I am obliged to you, Lord Taita. Your confidence in me is most gratifying. Remrem had the knack of making even these fine sentiments sound pompous. I drew a deep breath and went on, When I follow you, 2 weeks later, I will bring up the horses. I will also keep Captain Zaras and Colonel Hui with me in the second party. I will need Hui to manage the horses. I looked at him, and he nodded. Hui could not bear to be separated from his beloved animals. Then I turned to Zaras. 2 weeks from now, you should be sufficiently recovered from your wounds to travel safely. My plan was little short of genius. The princesses would go ahead with Remrem. I would keep Zaras and Hui with me. With a single stroke, I had separated the girls from the boys and arranged that both Zaras and all my livestock arrived in Babylon, well-watered and in fine fettle. Most importantly, I had ensured that my princesses would also arrive intact and untapped. I did not want to look at Tahuti. I hoped that I had left her with no space in which to maneuver, so that she would capitulate gracefully. No. Her voice was soft but distinct. I don't think that is a good idea at all, Lord Taita. Once more I had become Lord Taita, and not Darling Taita. I knew that I had been over-optimistic. I reached into my sleeve and took hold of the royal hawk seal, which I always carried with me. I needed all the authority I could muster. I am so very sorry to hear that, Your Royal Highness. I was certain that you would see the necessity of making these arrangements, as Lord Remrem did so readily. I produced the hawk seal from my sleeve and rubbed it between my fingers, absent-mindedly. Oh, you're offering that bauble to me? Without waiting for my answer, she reached up and took it from my hand. I was so surprised that I relinquished it without protest. Is it true what they say, Lord Taita?
What do they say, Your Highness?
They say that whoever holds the hawk seal speaks with the voice of Pharaoh.
Yes, Your Highness, that is true.
Look who is holding it now, my lord.
By now the other three men in the tent were aware that a trial of wills was in progress, and they were attempting unsuccessfully to hide their fascination. It was obvious even to me that I was starting to look ridiculous. I felt the frown beginning to crease my forehead, and I smoothed it away as I bowed dutifully to Tahuti.
I wait to hear you speak with the noble voice of Pharaoh. I attempted a small jest. It was not well received. Tahuti's smile crumbled into tragic ruins, and her lovely eyes flooded with tears. Oh, darling Taita, she whispered, and it was almost a sob. Please don't be so cruel to me. You are the only father I have ever known. Don't send me away, I beg you. You promised my brother and my mother that you would always take care of me. You're the only man I love and trust. Her voice choked, and she handed the hawk seal back to me. Here, take it. Send me away if you must. I will do whatever you command me.
Our interested audience stopped smiling. Their expressions became dismayed and horrified. In unison they turned their recriminatory gaze on me. I was suddenly the villain. Of course, none of them were aware of just what a consummate actress she is. She made me appear to be a bully and an utter dastard. In a moment, I lost all stomach for the contest. Forgive me, Tahuti. Tell me what you want, and I will give it to you.
Becketha and I just want to stay with you, our real father, that is all."
She choked back another sob, but that was superfluous. She knew she had won. She had achieved her purpose without once mentioning the name of the man whom we were really squabbling over. 4 days later, in the cool of the late afternoon, Lord Remrem marched with half our company towards the oasis of Zainab, 200 leagues to the north. I took Tahuti with me, and we rode out with Remrem to see him safely launched on the first 5 leagues of his journey. Then at last we made our farewells, and the two of us turned back towards Maya Kayev. Our bodyguard of 20 blue crocodile guards fell in behind us at a discreet distance, close enough to rush to our rescue if danger threatened, but not close enough to overhear our conversation. Before we left the Maya Kayev, we had invited Princess Becketha to ride with us, but to my astonishment she had declined, with the excuse that she wished to complete the scroll of hieroglyphics which I had set as part of her lessons. Becketha was not usually such a diligent and dedicated pupil. Now I was about to learn who had instigated her sudden interest in writing. For the first league, Tahuti and I rode stirrup to stirrup in companionable silence. Then she asked me suddenly,
"You knew my father very well, didn't you? I know almost nothing about him. You have never spoken of him before. Please tell me about him, Taita."
"Everybody in Egypt knows your father very well. He was the divine god Pharaoh Mamos, the 8th of that name and line. He was the pillar of the realm, the just, the great, the all-seeing, the all-merciful."
"No, he was not," she contradicted me flatly. "Please don't lie to me, darling Taita."
This accusation scattered my wits across the desert, and I turned in the saddle and stared at her in alarm as I gathered them up again. "It seems that I have been misinformed." I attempted a dismissive laugh, but it sounded flat, even to me. "If it was not Pharaoh, then please tell me who was the person fortunate enough to have you for a daughter. I truly do envy him."
"My true father was Lord Tanus, and his father was Pianki, Lord Harab. His mother was a freed Tehenu slave, with the fair hair and blue eyes that I have inherited. They say that she was very beautiful. They say that my father took after her, and that he was also very beautiful. They say that he was the most beautiful man in Egypt."
"Who told you all this?" I was about to say, "all this arrant nonsense," but with an effort I was able to check myself.
"My own mother told me, Queen Lostris. Now tell me that she lied to me."
I was bewildered, and as close as I have ever been to complete panic. The throne of Pharaoh and the foundations of my very Egypt were shaking. The firmament was about to fall in upon me. This was the most dangerous utterance I had ever heard. "Who else have you told?" I gasped at last.
"Nobody, only you."
"Do you know what will happen if you ever did tell anybody else?"
"Darling Taita, I am not a complete idiot."
She leaned out of the saddle and took my hand, like a mother calming her frightened child. "Are you certain you have not spoken of this to your brother?" I demanded, my voice rising, shrill in my own ears.
"Does Pharaoh know about this? Becketha? Have you told her?"
"No." Her voice was calm, reassuring. "Becketha is still a silly little girl, and it would kill Mem if he knew he was not the true Pharaoh."
"Your mother told you that as well?"
I shook her hand urgently. By now I was terrified. "She told you everything? Please say that I have misunderstood. Please."
"You understood me perfectly. My mother told me that all three of us are the offspring of Lord Tanus, and not those of Pharaoh Mamos. We are three little bastards."
"Why are you telling me all this now, Tehuti?"
"Because I am soon going to be in a very similar position to that in which my mother was caught up. You saved her."
She started, and I shook my head in denial.
Do not shake your head at me, Lord Taita.
She laughed at me.
She actually laughed in my face. You saved my mother, and now you must do the same for me.
This much was true. Queen Lostris had been the only true love of my life, but now she was gone, and Tehuti had taken her place. I could deny her nothing, but I could at least state my own rules and conditions. She would almost certainly ignore them, just as her mother had done, but at least I would have made the effort.
Tell me exactly what you require of me, Tehuti. My mother was married to a king, but she had the husband of her own choice. She bore his children, not those of the king. She could not have done that on her own. You helped her achieve all that. Isn't that what happened?
Yes. That is what happened, I confessed. It seemed the only course open to me.
I have lived in my brother's harem most of my life, Tehuti continued. He has 200 wives, but he only loves one of them. Masara was the first of all of them, and she has given him 3 sons. If I could have what she has, then I would be content. But I have watched the misery of his other wives. Most of them have not been visited by my brother more than once or twice in all the time they have been his wives.
Do you know what they do, Taita? She demanded, and her tone was heavy with disapproval. I shook my head, and she went on.
They play with themselves, or with the other women of the harem, instead of with a man whom they want and love. They have toy penises made from ivory or silver. They push these horrid things up into themselves or into each other. She broke off and shuddered. It is so sad. I don't want to be like them.
I saw her face change, become bleak with sorrow. I saw the sudden tears well up in the inner corners of her eyes. Now she was no longer acting.
I know that you are going to take me to a strange and foreign land. There you will give me to an old man who is all wrinkled and grey, someone with cold hands and a foul breath that will sicken me to the pit of my stomach. He will do ugly things to me. She choked back a sob. Just once, before that happens, I want to have what you gave to my mother. I want to have a man who makes me laugh and makes my heart beat faster. I want a man who truly loves me, and whom I truly love.
You want Zaras.
I spoke softly, and she raised her chin and met my gaze through the tears. Yes, I want Zaras. Just once I want to be in love and hold that precious thing to my heart. I want to have Zaras as my husband and to have him deep inside me. If you give me that, for just a little space of time, then I will gladly go and do my duty for my Pharaoh, for Egypt, and for you, my darling Taita.
Will you promise me that, Tehuti? Will you tell no other person ever, not even your own children?
My mother,
she started, but I cut her protest short. There were special circumstances with your mother. They will not be the same in your case. You must promise me truly.
I promise you truly, she agreed,
and I could not doubt her. You must understand that you will not be able to bear Zara's children. Not ever.
I wish it were not so, Taita. I would dearly love to have a little Zara's of my very own, but I know that it has to be the way you say.
Every month, when the red flower of your womanhood is due to blossom, I will give you a draught to drink. The infant will be carried out of your womb on the tide of your blood.
I will weep to think on it.
When you become the wife of the Supreme Minos, you will forsake Zaras for all time. You will abide in the royal harem in Crete. Zaras will return to Egypt. You will never see him again. Do you understand that, Tehuti? She nodded her head. Speak, I commanded her. Say that you understand.
I understand, she spoke up, clearly.
On the night of your wedding to the Minos, I will prepare a lamb's bladder of blood for you. It will burst when he takes you to his bed. It will convince him of your virginity and your chastity.
I understand, she whispered.
You will tell nobody, I insisted, not even Becketha, especially not Becketha. Her little sister was an inveterate chatterbox and famously unable to keep a secret.
I will tell nobody, she agreed, not even my little sister.
Do you understand what danger you will be in, Tehuti? The Minos will have the power of life and death over you. It is foolhardy to cheat a king. You must take the utmost care, never to be discovered.
I understand. I know it, that you are taking the same risk as I am. I love you all the more for that.
Of course, it was madness. But I have done many mad things in my life. My only consolation was that I still had a tiny breathing space in which to make my preparations. Zara's wounds placed a restraint upon him. He was not yet in a condition to embark upon the wilder excesses of love. However, he was healing swiftly.